Welcome to episode 54 of the Pilot's Journey podcast. We discuss aviation, proficiency, and enjoying the journey. My name is Stuart Stevenson, a.k.a. Pilot Stu, a CFI and aircraft distributor in North Dallas.
And I'm Mike Hart, a.k.a. Mike Stu, a commercial rated pilot and aircraft owner in Idaho Falls, Idaho.
I'm Stuart Stoll, a.k.a. CFI Stu, flight instructor out of Fort Worth, Texas.
This episode, we discuss expos, gadgets, survival, and natural selection. All this and more on the Pilot's Journey podcast.
Pirep.
It's good to be back podcasting, I have to say. We went through all the holidays and a long break there, but I guess we're back, ready to record. A lot's happened since the last time we recorded. I finally decided to go back to work, but it's one thing led to another, and now I'm about to help run a 141 school as an assistant chief flight instructor. So I'm currently preparing for my assistant chief flight instructor rating and check ride. I guess it's not really a rating, but I still have a check ride with our POI. And then tailwheel endorsement and a multi-engine instructor check ride also in the works coming up. So I have been studying like crazy. And in addition to that, studying like crazy, I've also gone back and started studying the FOIs again, because I have a CFI applicant that I'm training, and so I'm going through all the FOIs as well. And so I just am going through books and books of material, trying to get myself up to knowledge standards. So that's going to be really fun. We expect to have that 141 running here in, I want to say, probably by the end of April. And so we're running around with the FAA, watching them drag their feet as this process is slow, but it's looking really positive. And but I'm with a flight school right next to you, Stu, actually, in Addison Airport. I'm one taxi over on what is it? What am I on? I'm over there at Atlantic by Gulf. Aero Aviation over there.
Yeah, real familiar with them. Pretty decent operation. They have a Diamond Star there?
Yeah, we have, a wide array of aircraft, actually. We are looking to get on open airplane here soon, too. But we have four Cessna 172S models, two of which are G1000. The other two are steam gauges with KLA-94 and HSI. Full autopilot. They all have full autopilot, all low time, leather interior. Then we have a Diamond Star 40, the DA-40 over there, in really good condition, full G1000 on that too. We have a Cessna 310 Q model, new leather interior, new instrument panel with, it's got a place where you can place your iPad on the instrument panel. It's pretty neat. We have, what else do we have? We have a Cutlass 172RG, and we have a Bonanza, a B-36 Turbo. Really good condition on that one. Backup, Aspen Avionics, full Garmin touchscreen integrated, stuff. It's all good, really cool stuff. And then we are about to acquire a Piper Saratoga, also 300 horsepower. Saratoga. I can't decide if I want to take the 310, the Saratoga, or the Diamond Star up to Oshkosh.
I know which one's cheaper on gas.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm actually kind of leaning towards the Saratoga.
I'm assuming the Diamond is cheaper on gas.
Oh, yes. Yeah. The Diamond's a lot cheaper on gas. Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. The Saratoga would be pretty roomy, though.
It would be. Well, the 310 is super roomy, also, actually.
yeah.
The 310 is super roomy. You can really spread out in that airplane.
At 26 gallons per hour, I'd hope so. Yeah.
Yes. Well, we get it down to about 24. It's pretty good. This one leans out really well. It burns about it can burn about 11 per side in cruise, which isn't bad.
On a long haul, what's the endurance in terms of hours, and B, how high do you get up at that?
Well, I can't really, it's not turboed, but I can't really remember if we talked about this in the last podcast or not, but I actually flew up to Oregon to pick it up and ferry it back to Texas. So I got a lot of good cross-country time in it. I want to say, man, its endurance is a long time. It gets up there and it stays up there. I flew
We haven't talked about that because I remember seeing you because I was out. I was up flying and you were tweeting your flight path while I was out flying as well. So I actually was watching you tweet.
Yes. I had so much fun. That 310 took me from Palm Springs, California, all the way into Texas to not Lubbock. Was it Lubbock? No, it wasn't Lubbock. Abilene. All the way there. So it took me from Palm Springs all the way to Abilene, Texas. And that's a long way. That's four states right there.
That's more endurance than I have.
Yes.
I was going to say, hell, Texas is four states.
Yeah, Texas is four states.
Well, I've had to cross Texas because I flew from, Idaho to Texas, and damn, I was in Texas an awful long time.
Man, let me tell you, that leg from California into Texas kind of took us really close to the Mexico border, and that leg along the Mexico border there is, it's kind of, it's a little scary because we're dodging tethered zeppelins with infrared cameras like pointed at the border, and the Edwards Air Force Base I think was near there, and
there's a lot of
drones. We were dodging drones. I'm not even joking.
Really?
Yes, drones everywhere along that border as we were flying into Texas, and so it was very interesting. I've never experienced anything like that. It was just a ton of military traffic and a ton of just tethered balloons and stuff that we were just missing. And it was quite interesting. Off the right wing is... Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I remember when I was flying there, seeing those tethered... I only saw the one that was anywhere near my flight path. But it kind of gets your attention, where it's a little prohibited area and a circle, but it's a tiny little pimple of a circle.
Yeah.
But then you read it, and it's like, oh, crap. I wouldn't want to hit that.
yeah, you don't want to hit that for many reasons.
Yeah,
exactly right. So it's got a ton of range. It's got great speed. It cruises really nice. So I'm a really big fan of it, and that's why I'm kind of thinking about bringing it up to Oshkosh. You may be able to make it up there. Probably not. I would probably stop for fuel, but you could probably make it probably all the way to Oshkosh. You could go nonstop to Oshkosh, which is why I'm really thinking, considering the 310. I'm looking to see really get this Saratoga in and see its endurance and range and performance and how good it is. It may have a few maintenance squawks on it when we get it, so it may not be Oshkosh ready by the time it's up and on the flight line, but definitely considering bringing the 310 in. For sure. And I'm looking for people to share rides with, too.
But can you say that? If you say that, have you just violated the FAA's law?
Sounds like you're holding out.
No, because we would be pro rata share of the cost.
Well, are you holding out, though? That's the question.
I'm not holding out. I'm not holding out because I'm not charging anybody for anything.
Yeah.
That's still a gray area.
You're not posting it on a website, but if you just mentioned it and advertised it on this podcast...
Not for hire, people. I'm not accepting money to fly you to Oshkosh. That is something I am not doing. Absolutely.
Well, I would
you
be
guys. You guys are going to get me in trouble. That is not what I was saying.
And there's no way I'm editing that out.
Yeah. Oh, no. No. No, don't edit it out because then it even looks more shady.
I just saw that's currently in dispute there on the whole... FAA coming down on the the equivalent of
the ride sharing sites.
Yeah. Uber, yeah, the ride sharing sites, and it's like, it's if you can legitimately put your name up on a bulletin board on a piece of paper at an FBO, I really don't understand the distinction between the two. I mean, I do and I don't. So I read Rod Rake wrote a really good article that described it as to why that distinction is important and how it's different from open airplane.
Yes,
but at the same time, I still think FAA is kind of has a little bit of a cranial rectal inversion on that one too.
Well, half the FAA guys know the regs and the other half don't. I mean, I've corrected FAA guys ramp checking, saying that, you know, instructors needed a second class medical in order to teach and things like that, which is obviously it's not true, at least a third class. And that's only if you have to act as PIC. So I've had to show the regs to the FAA guys a few times to correct them. So so that's my personal experience. So whatever they say and whatever my lawyer will say, I tend to go that route. So, but
we won't inquire as to whether there were any passengers along with you if you arrive at Oshkosh and how they managed to get on board.
Doesn't Oshkosh like support a bunch of like sites where pilots can say, "Hey, I'm going to Oshkosh. Does anyone want to go?" Like that's
there used to be. There was Pilot Share the Ride before the other flight things. The reality is there's a lot. All kinds of bulletin boards where you could say, "Hey, I'm going to Oshkosh. PM me if you're interested." And because I think all pilots know that it's legit to split the gas, and a lot of pilots are going to go to Osh or be looking for a ride to Osh, it makes perfect sense to
to
hook up and share the ride and share the expense. And we all know the rules. That's the whole thing, is we all know those regs.
Yep. So. Yep. Where I get confused at is, can I hold out for my flight instruction? So can I say, "Hey, I'm looking to teach someone. You can pay me for if I teach you," and then we just happen to go to Oshkosh during our flight training. You know, that's where it gets really gray. That's shady right there. That's real shady. But I didn't know, like, if holding out involved with flight instruction, which I should probably know that, but it's something I just haven't looked at in a long time.
So if you did that and charged as a flight instructor, if you were doing it in somebody else's airplane and charging, that would be fine, wouldn't it? I mean, you're just exercising your commercial privileges as an instructor, and the person has their airplane, and if they choose to pay you as an instructor, wouldn't it be only an issue if you're renting a plane?
Because the pilot's not making any profit at that point. So if the pilot's not making profit for the flight, that's the thing. And so it would be if the instructor owned the airplane and he's going to Oshkosh. Right. And you're kind
I see what you mean by that being kind of shady.
And so now, is he going to make profit because he's flying you, or is he making profit because he's teaching you? And then which one of those can you hold out for? Because you can obviously not hold out for the one going to Oshkosh. But you may be able to hold out for flight instruction. You can, as a flight instructor, you have to advertise your services as a flight instructor somehow, right?
You can hold out as a flight instructor.
The whole holding out comes from competing with actual air carriers, which are regulated and things like that. So we can't compete with them. Plus, there's also safety issues, like Rod Rakic posted about too, when that starts happening, because you have no idea what airplane you're getting in most of the time.
Right. Airplane. Although I would argue that an airplane that gets 100-hour inspections is less safe than an airplane that only gets annuals.
I could argue that.
So it's one of those things where the big difference is the level of inspection that is required if you have an airplane that you are renting, and therefore it is part of the holding out part.
I will have to say that I've been a part of some flight schools that do 100 hours, and their aircraft are incredibly shady.
I think that's the thing, is every time you take an airplane apart and put it back together, something is your first hour or two is a test. You're a test pilot. So that, again, Mike Bush has written articles, and I've written articles on that whole issue of, maintenance. If you can not do maintenance and only do it when it's needed, as opposed to just prescriptively doing it on a schedule because the FAA tells you you have to, which is, again, what the 100-hour inspection is. You end up, again, I think you expose yourself to greater risk by having excessive inspections. But
I don't know, Stuart. You run a flight school. How do you feel about the 100-hour?
We do about one a month on each plane.
So. You feel like it makes airplanes better or...
Well, you catch things. That's essentially an annual inspection every month.
So the question is, do you end up, the study was in World War II, where those kinds of prescriptive every 50-hour or every 100-hour inspections, the airplanes always had more maintenance issues after coming out of maintenance than they did if you left them and did not do the maintenance. In other words, maintenance caused them to have post-maintenance problems.
There may be diminishing returns based on how complex the aircraft is. You're talking about an old World War II Warbird versus...
Yeah, they were Spitfires.
Spitfires versus, you know, a sport cruiser.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot that is done on a 100-hour annual inspection.
Yeah, I was just saying, you know, that's one of the things I would imagine, actually. There aren't that many inspection plates, that many things that you're really investigating, and you're not really changing rigging or really changing moving parts. I actually think it has a lot to do with moving parts and engine stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, even if you left the inspection plates open, it's just more drag. It's not going to hurt anything.
Right. Yeah, I think you're right. Simpler aircraft, probably not as big a deal. So, Stu, other Stu, what have you been doing?
Well, I guess I haven't been doing a lot of flying other than just normal instructional stuff. I did go to the Sebring U.S. Sport Aircraft Expo in Sebring. Unfortunately, I flew there in the back of a big silver tube. I didn't, you know, the weather wouldn't let us get our planes there. We had a local dealer that actually brought a plane in for the show, so that we weren't empty, but it was less than ideal. But it was a really good show. Not much as far as new announcements or you know, new products, but we did sell a couple airplanes, and I saw a bunch of friends. It was really great to have a chance to talk to people that hadn't seen in a while. There was one fatal crash at the site. It was a seaplane, I think a Sea Ray or something similar. Unfortunately, it looked like it was either an accelerated stall, they're trying to turn a little too quickly, or possibly some sort of structural failure. I haven't seen any reports come out of it yet. That was really only the downside of the show, other than a little bit cold and windy. But while we were there, we also ordered a couple of custom parachutes for aerobatics. And that was leading up to the new Extreme Decathlon that came in. And that is a beast. There's no muffler on it. It's just headers. And that thing is loud and powerful.
Is it flying a lot? I don't think I've seen it take off when I'm out around Madison. I plane watch a lot, and I don't think I've seen it yet.
We've only really flown it once. Patrick and I took it up when we got back from Sebring, just really to kind of shake it out a little bit. And we've been so busy with a bunch of stuff going on, we haven't really had time to take it out. We can't really do the aerobatics till the parachutes come in either.
Okay. All right. So, give me a call when that happens. I want to take it up.
Yeah.
We've got a list.
Yeah, I bet you do.
But we're not holding out.
Have a flight
it's
school.
All it's all instruction no that. It's all instruction your school it's all instruction
that's right
you do it you're not competing with any air carrier it's okay.
No, I'm not. Mike, what have you been up to?
Oh man, all kinds of flying. I have had I really, really love the fact that I get to use my airplane for business, the fact that I have a contract that's, you know, 400 nautical miles away that I get to go to every month or so. This month or this year or in January, I've been there twice. And so I've you know, just racking up long hours, and it's so much better than driving. One of the challenges was we were originally going to go, but then the guy I was taking up there to shoot some video, his wife was really sick. And had to go to the hospital, and so we postponed the trip, which was perfect because it sounds awful. I've never felt so bad and guilty because her medical condition meant we delayed our trip, which meant that the weather got better so we could actually fly instead of having to drive. So I don't want to ever wish ill on anybody, but at the same time, it was convenient because it lagged our departure by a day, which got us into good weather. And so we were able to fly, which also meant we got back faster. And on that one, it was a fun, I'm trying to think, well, I've done three trips and they're 3 hours each direction. So, you know, that's quite a few hours, and a bunch of them have been VFR. A couple have been, about half have been IFR, where I just have to punch through a layer when I get to Richland where, just to get through a valley inversion. And one of the big challenges there is, you know, just verifying there's no ice, because we're kind of in a marginal season, but it's at 400 feet above sea level, so it's really low. But it's still winter there. But typically I've got good pyrex or negative icing on the forecasts, And so I've been able to launch IFR, and it's literally just punching through a 1,000-foot layer. But it's fun because I actually get to use my rating, and that's always entertaining to stay current and use the rating and shoot an approach. It's just a localizer without the ILS. So that's the main approach I've been shooting, although I also have had some trips returning back to Idaho Falls where I, again, had a nice, my plan was to go from, in this case, I couldn't get into Richland because the weather got so bad. It was a freezing fog layer at 200 feet, and I was flying in at night, and I'm not interested in shooting an approach to less than minimums at night in freezing fog. So I opted to land at a, yeah, I know.
Sissy.
Yeah. One of those things, not wanting to participate in a natural selection event. So when the weather was originally forecast at like 900 feet, but just before my departure, it went down to, on the ground, but I had, a two hour drive away from, Richland is Lewiston, Idaho, 2.5 hours. So the forecast over Idaho Falls, over the wilderness into Lewiston, was clear. So I just went from, took off, had clear conditions, but it was night, flying at night over the mountains, but it's a route that I know really well, so I really know where the mountain ranges are, where the bumps are, what altitudes to be at, did my trip. And then when I came back, the problem was there was a valley inversion over my home airport, so I originally just planned on flying from one clear airport to another, and then en route I saw some pyreps that showed negative ice. And just ahead of me getting into the Idaho Falls Airport, another Pilatus went through the layer and got, again, confirmed no ice. So I shot my approach and was able to break out and had a good time. I'm getting to where I really actually love flying IFR, although really would be nice to have an autopilot. And although that's one of the things, because I'm flying in airports I fly into all the time, I'm not going to say I memorize the plate, but I know what the approach is. I know the mist. I'm not having to brief the approach every time because I'm flying approaches that I fly all the time.
I have to say, Mike, I'm currently flying planes that have like the G1000 integrated autopilot, where you do things with flight director and flight level change with the autopilot. And it's really nice. But after a while, I keep thinking, it's like, man, I used to be able to hand fly this. I wonder if I can still do it. And that thought, it's kind of takes you back a little bit, like maybe I'll just turn the autopilot off for a while and hand fly it.
Well, that's one of the things. So one of the first approaches I did, kind of where it was really getting back into IFR, I've been maintained my currency under the hood, etc. But there's a difference between, when you have been maintaining your currency by hood work, and then when it's time to actually go into the real stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And one of the things was, this ILN or a localizer approach, it's, again, just had this deck of fog, and Richland Airport is at 400 feet above sea level. The ceilings were at 600, and the tops were at 2,500. So, basically a 2,000 or 1,000-foot layer to go through. The initial approach fix, so I do a procedure turn going outbound, and I'm turning in to, and right as I'm turning in, I am facing east right into the sun, so I get blinded and I'm in my procedure turn, but I'm still above the clouds. And then right as I finish the turn, I drop into the clouds, roll out, and I'd just been blinded, so I had this combination of being above the clouds, into the sun, roll, and oh man, was that approach awful. I was just disoriented as hell. It was the first time I'd been in the soup for a long time. I was just all over the map, and finally I said, I'm going missed. I had barely even started the approach. I just was, the needles weren't, everything was just awful. So I just went missed, like a mile after the initial approach fixed. or maybe it was probably further in than that. Anyway, came back, did it again. This time stayed, you know, did the full turn and stayed above the clouds until I was, you know, had a stabilized approach and then dropped down into them. So I really only did IFR, you know, from the, where the whole thing was basically just lined up and flying a stabilized approach the whole way in rather than doing the turn in the clouds.
But I bet it was really satisfying once you popped out of that on that approach, right?
Oh, yeah.
Saw the runway. I bet that that was a great feeling then.
Well, in fact, you know, 600 is pretty low. And I was one of the things that kind of surprised me, relatively speaking, was that's probably it is the lowest I've ever had to break out. And, you know, it was a really low visibility. So not only was it 600 foot, but, you know, when I had contact with the ground, it's like, oh, there we are. I'm at 600. I'm seeing the ground, I'm looking forward, and it's like I see where the airport should be, but I was just, you know, a few hundred feet off of the needle, and, you know, at 600 feet, you're pretty dang close to the airport at that point, and I was looking for it in front of me, and it was just off to the right a little bit, and I was surprised how hard it was to find just a little bit off to the right, because it wasn't where I was looking for it to be.
Exactly, yep, that's a common error.
And it was like, again, the nice thing is a familiar airport. I know what the ground looks like, and it's like, hold it, this is off. That's that building off to the left. Oh, there it is. So, that's the nice thing is, you know, I don't know if I would have flown to minimums like or not. It wasn't really minimums, but to 600 feet, if I would have had, if it would have been a totally unfamiliar airport, you know.
I really. Yeah, with working with Stuart over at US Sport, doing all the sport training and stuff, and then taking a year off when my son was born, that was a few years of not really doing any instrument work, and my instrument skills were lacking there for me, and I had to get up and do an IPC pretty quick and go up in the clouds a little bit to get that back. But it's quite amazing, you know, how that skill depreciates if you don't use it.
Well, and I'm doing, you know, again, I've been flying a lot of IFR flight plans, and I've been in real actual IMC and doing the approaches because the airports are in IMC. But there's still kind of a difference. I'm still going to call it somewhat docile IFR from the standpoint of the fact that I'm really above the clouds as I'm intercepting the final approach fix. So the initial approach fix. I'm above the clouds, you know, and then enter the clouds when I really are already on a straight line into the airport, which is a lot easier than having to do procedure turns and all that kind of crazy stuff in the clouds.
Yeah. I understand. That makes sense.
So the more I do it, the more I feel like, oh yeah, I could do that now in the clouds, but I still am comfortable staying, making an effort to actually stay above the clouds. It's like, you know, cleared to the fix at or above a certain number. It's like, well, the tops are that number, so I'm going to stay above that number.
You turned outbound on the procedure turn when you noticed your vacuum pump failed, and that's right when ATC decides to give you a holding clearance. What do you do? Yeah, none of that crazy stuff.
yeah. So, yeah, what else? I just filled out my form 8500 for my FAA medical, so I'm going to get that done on Monday. So look forward to getting that taken care of. And then I got a couple articles. It's kind of interesting. One of them is I did some writing for AOPA on pilot survival, so we can talk about that a little bit. But the other one is Gadget Flight Rules, got published in Aviation Safety recently. And that one of the things I was going to talk about it, or suggest we talk about a little bit for a featured topic, is gadgets in the cockpit, because there's that goofy thing that happened with the pilot in a fatal thing that happened, but has really been reported bizarrely in the media.
The media handling of it is so weird. Oh my gosh. Yeah. For those who don't know what we're talking about, there was a recent fatal crash, where the, Was it the NTSB or was the FAA thought that it was because he was taking a selfie?
Yeah, I think it was NTSB.
Yeah, the NTSB felt like he was taking a selfie during a critical phase of their of flight, and that's why he crashed. And that's the media has been all over that, the selfie pilot.
Well, the one thing about it was the looking at, if you follow Bold Method, I get their Facebook posts, which are really quite good. But they, did a kind of a post-mortem, if you will, on the flight, all the 12 different things that were factors in what was going on in the pilot who was flying a Cessna 150 at night with conditions that were, to be honest, potentially IFR, because I think it may have had can't remember if it was a scattered layer or if it was a broken layer at 200 feet or something like that. But it was, having been up at night in with those kinds of fog banks where you see, again, scattered layers, if you end up in one of those clouds at pattern altitude, which is probably what it looks like this pilot did, selfie, no selfie, the fact that he had an iPhone and had been taking pictures in the cockpit, and apparently pictures that may have involved the flash, which is, I think, what they were speculating, because the flash went off. And I suppose if the date stamp or time stamp on the photo corresponded to there was a flash followed by pilot disorientation, then that probably is a pretty linked cause.
Yeah, but I'm sure it's one. It's never one thing that leads to.
I was just gonna say, but being up
it's
in the
never cockpit, one. I mean, his. It sounds like even his go no go decision making skills were probably at fault there too. It's just
right.
Wow.
Well, and that was one of the things that I think, if they're gonna say it, that cause and effect, it's like, well, give us that much more data, because the fact that you found a photo in the cockpit, I mean, if it was taken 15 minutes before he lost control, then I don't see a cause and effect. Right. If it was taken immediately after that, the plane started the death spiral, then I think you've got a pretty good cause.
I'm pretty sure his attention on the cell phone during a critical phase of flight could definitely have contributed to a crash, but there's going to be more than that too. That's going to be
exactly. He probably shouldn't have been up in those conditions.
Yeah,
wasn't night. Exactly. Well, I think there's speculation. He wasn't may have not been night current, which of course is a big issue. Then whether he's instrument current, because I think he was an instrument rated pilot, but I doubt there are many Cessna 150s that are instrument qualified, and he was flying without. Talking to ATC, so he clearly wasn't flying
Did you see the other pilot that was taking selfies with his GoPro and his Cirrus 22 after he had a engine failure on his way to Hawaii, I think it was?
Oh yeah. So he's a hero.
He was pretty cool. So the story on this one is a Cirrus pilot was flying out to Hawaii over the ocean, and halfway out over the ocean, just massive engine failure, and he knew he was going to have to ditch, so he pulled the chute. And then there's a video of him with his GoPro filming the whole thing inside after the chute is already pulled and as he's floating down to the water, and he films the whole thing. It's very fascinating. A little bit different scenario from what we were just talking about, but still, he was recording and taking photos the whole way down. It was quite interesting to see it from inside the cockpit.
Well, yeah. At that point, he was a passenger, though.
Yeah, at that point, true. He was a passenger, yeah.
The one thing, if you've been in a Cirrus, which I've only been in one once, but that where they when you do the briefing and they say, and this handle, actually, I guess I've been in a couple airplanes where they have the ballistic parachute, but when they point to it, and part of pointing to it involves kind of touching it, it's kind of like touching the trigger guard of a weapon.
It really is. Oh my gosh! All those sport cruisers that Stuart and I have flown, they have those parachutes too.
But when you touch it, don't you kind of get the jibblies somehow?
Oh yeah.
I don't know if I should even be touching that. That was the thing that crossed my mind was the guy from heading to Hawaii was, not only did he have to touch it, but it's like, okay, the engine's not working. I've got nothing but ocean underneath me.
Recently
pull that sucker. That would just be, I don't know if it's fun, terrifying, but very consequential action of reaching in, grabbing that puppy, and yanking.
You know, the Diamond Star 40 has a, the G1000 model has a backup, emergency backup battery, and it's got a switch with a toggle cover over it. I forget what you call those little red switches that you have to flip up and then you can flip the switch. You know what I mean? Like a hat switch or something like that.
The kind for nuclear missiles where you have to have
You have to insert the key with the other guy and count down and then both turn the key at the same time. Well, it also has a copper wire wrapped around it. And if the copper wire is ever broken, the airplane is immediately no longer certified for IFR. And the battery, the whole battery, you have to take the airplane apart and completely replace the battery inside. And then a mechanic has to tie the little copper wire back around. And so what happens is you get little kids in the airplane. I'm calling them kids, but I'm pretty sure they're adults. And they like to flip open the thing and break the copper wire. Just by playing around, they're like, oh, this is neat, and they flip around. And I was expecting over at US Sport with Stuart, one day we'd be in the hangar talking, and we'd just hear a bang, and we'd go outside, and someone on the ramp had accidentally just blown the chute while sitting on the ramp, you know. I was expecting that would happen any day.
It hasn't yet.
but the chute, if I remember correct, there's a big red chute handle in those sport cruisers with a large metal pin in. And then do you tie the pin down, or is it a breakaway pin, or do you have to pull the pin and then pull the chute? I forget how it works.
You just have to pull the pin out on most of them. There was one year during 2014, they had a little plastic guard on it that would prevent you from pulling the handle. So you had to break a little string and pull the pin and then pull the handle, which for this year, they've decided that wasn't such a good idea, and they got rid of that. So it's now just back to a pen.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Those things always worried me too. Because also in the sport cruisers, that parachute handle is right above the throttle quadrant in it. So they reach for the throttle and he kind of gets near where that parachute handle is. And I keep thinking that they're looking outside and they reach down to grab a handle and they don't look and see which one they grab. So I've always been.
Well, that's why we don't pull the pin that says remove before flight. We choose to leave that particular one in.
We'll leave that pin in. And that's probably why you haven't had that kind of situation happen yet. So that's probably good thinking.
Well, I admire or not envy, I guess, the fact that all the airplanes you described in your flight school have such high end stuff.
They're so high end. I'm now, for a long time there, I was like, I need to get G1000 proficient. I don't really fly airplanes with G1000. Flew the Dynons. I got Dynon proficient. But I was like, man, I really want to just do the G1000 thing. And, you know, I went through the little iPad course and I studied some courses there and I flew with a few airplanes G1000. But now, now I feel like, you know, I teach the stuff every day now. And that G1000, it's really hard to transition back to other steam gauges. We have our, what do we have? We have, I want to say our Cutlass. Our Cutlass is the only airplane we have that doesn't have a GPS in it. And it's really, it gets exciting for me to fly that airplane because now that airplane is the challenge over these technically advanced aircraft, which used to be a challenge for me. So I remember. Yeah, I still remember trying to figure out where the torque, the rate of turn was on the G1000 for the longest time. I still remember trying to figure that out.
In some ways, I guess I kind of like flying old school with the 180, but I do miss the Aspen in the 206. That was the Aspen in the 430. That combo is just pretty killer. It's hard to beat.
Yes. Yeah. The Aspen is pretty nice. I like the Aspen. We have the Aspen. We have some Aspen, the attitude indicator and heading indicator backup, dual backup to some steam gauges in the Bonanza, which is pretty nice. I had a student recently, I was teaching a student cross country and he was doing his primary flight training in G1000 Cessnas. And one of the Cessnas was no longer available during a lesson and it was during a cross country flight lesson. And I needed to teach the kid pilotage and dead reckoning anyway. So on this flight, it was pilotage, so I gave him a sectional chart, and I took him up in the Cessna, which still has a GPS in it. It's just a KLA-94, though. But we took him up in that, and the whole time he's like, I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know what any of this is. What is this? It's like, that's your heading indicator. He's like, I don't like this. I don't like it. Like, suck it up.
Well, that's one of the things I really like about the Dynon Skyviews. They've added sometime last year, I think. There's a mode that you can press and switch it so it's a full six pack. It gets rid of all the fancy stuff, and you just got a six pack on the screen in front of you.
I like that. I like that a lot. That's pretty cool.
It's real common to get a student that gets fixated inside. Uh-huh. And you know, one time I've turned off the screen on their side. I've also thrown it into six-pack mode, and that's might as well turn it off for some of them. It takes them a while to learn how to use that. But I always do some flying on the cross countries now in the six-pack mode, just so that they don't become over reliant on the glass.
I would think, you know, one of the big things. I mean, you can I can sound like an old grumpy old man. You know, back in the day, you kids get off my lawn.
I will say that is a pretty accurate representation of what you sound like. So,
but well, that's good. But you know, one of the things is it's not so much that, because I think if you just stay in G1000, then you really don't need to learn how to fly the other stuff. But you won't ever get the chance to fly other stuff because you know the rental fleet when that G1000 is out and there's something with steam gauges. I mean, it's not that, so much that it's a critical skill. But it's your opportunity to fly airplanes that you know use those old school instruments. It opens more doors.
Yeah, and that exactly. And the private pilot rating, it's single engine land in this case, and so you fly single engine land. You know, that's not high performance or complex or anything that requires an additional endorsement to fly, or type ratings. So I mean, if you happen to find yourself, you know, with an airplane that you're going to go up and fly, and you don't have a G1000 equipped airplane, and plus this kid is from, I keep telling this kid anyway, I won't mention his name, but he was actually a great student. I'm kind of making fun of him here, but he was actually one of my better students. Got him done right at 40 hours. He was a pretty smart kid. But he's coming from Alaska, and his father owns a ton of airplanes, including Piper Cubs and a Kodiak, and none of them are glass. I keep telling him, I was like, he was getting a rating so he can go and fly his father's airplanes, and none of them were glass cockpit. So I kept telling him that. It's like, you still need to know this, because this isn't the kind of airplanes you're going to be flying, so... I'm so envious. He's got a Kodiak on floats. Oh, it's such a good
man. I would love to fly one of those.
I know, up through Alaska, a Kodiak on floats through Alaska. Yeah, I was pretty jelly there. I was pretty.
That's a lot of airplane.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it
man.
Is.
Featured site.
Okay, well, we have a featured site. We were talking about, you know, a little bit earlier about air safety and some of the stuff that you might need to help in the case of a survival event. And it just so happens that one of our podcasters here just wrote an article on that.
So yeah, if you go to Air Safety Institute and then /safety-spotlights, and that's safety and spotlights with a capital S, /survival-safety, both of those having capital S's, you will go to a new series that AOPA did on survival. And basically, it's survival safety, and they published a video called Survival Beyond the Forced Landing, and I had the chance to contribute to the Safety Advisor Survive Beyond the Forced Landing, which is basically, it's a printed guide, a 12-page guide with lots of post-crash survival tips, tricks, references, checklists, equipment lists, and focused. Originally, this was done for the Canadian, for COPA, basically. They were the ones that provided the initial impetus. So there was a focus on Canadian situations and circumstances, which is not entirely unlike Idaho, depending on what part of Canada you're in. But I have the good fortune of having spent a lot of time in outdoors, working as an outward bound instructor, a river guide, river ranger, mountaineer. So I had a lot of background in survival. And so it was nice for AOPA to give me a call, give me the assignment, and then wrote that little piece for him. So the video is pretty good. In fact, it has a nice set of tips, so highly recommend it. It takes a little bit of time to go through it. And Obviously, I recommend the 12-page download because, well, it's just quality writing. That's what I'll say.
I really like the part where you have some of those Canadian aviation regulations in there, like the 60261 CAR, Canadian Aviation Regulation, where it talks about required survival equipment for flights over land. Like, starting a fire, providing shelter, providing or purifying water, and visually signaling distress.
And so
No person shall operate an aircraft over land unless there is carried on board survival equipment sufficient for the survival on ground for each person on board, given the geographical area. It's pretty interesting.
What happens is that there is a section, part of that is, I'm trying to think, there's one little caveat that allows, that kind of puts it at play where there's a kind of a get out of jail free if
an aircraft that is operated within 25 nautical miles of the aerodrome or departure that has the capability of radio communication.
Well, it's does not apply that is operated in a geographical area where at a time of year when survival of the persons on board is not jeopardized. So it's kind of, there's a chance for you to make your own decision. And say, well, I think our survival wouldn't be jeopardized. And the whole thing about that is, the opening story is in April of last year, there was a wreckage in Florida. And I did a look at it, and it had gone 6 months without being discovered. And when they discovered it, of course, it had the skeletal remains of the pilot because he hadn't been found for 6 months. And so he probably didn't survive the crash, but it was like 60 miles from Tampa. it was in one of the most densely populated states of the United States.
That's some Bravo airspace near in and around.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. I mean, it was very close, where you're just barely outside the Mode C Vale. You know, there's some swamps and there's some areas that are dense forest, and that's what happened. Is the plane crashed, but it was 300 feet from, or 300 yards from a roadway. So it was literally right next to a road within 300 yards, but it was in a dense canopy of trees, so they couldn't see it from the air. And so it's one of those things where sometimes you think, well, I'm just flying from here to there, they'll find me. And the answer is, well, you know, it's amazing how hard it is to find an aircraft if it doesn't crash in the right spot. if it goes underneath the trees, you can be right there 65 miles from downtown Tampa and be 6 months out without ever anybody finding you. But the cool thing was at the end of the story, literally the day I filed in Winnipeg, just north of Thunder Bay, some pilots crashed, and it's the kind of the closing photo. And they did everything right. They had survival gear. They had everything they needed. They had set up a tent. And because they were equipped and prepared, their rescue went without any hitches whatsoever. So it was kind of cool. You have bookending the story of people who were really in a remote area doing it right. And again, this is wasn't a fault of the person flying that they didn't have safety gear. Again, they probably... The crash probably could have easily been what dealt the fatal blow, but it's surprising how hard it is to be discovered. And if you don't have a flight plan, if people aren't expecting you, every little factor that keeps the rescue from getting started will impede. It determines how long you're going to wait, and the wait times go down quickly if you're on an IFR flight plan. It's a very short time between last contact and rescue. And then if you don't have a flight plan, it's days, if not weeks.
And they say the first 24 hours is the most critical point by a long shot.
Yeah. And, and that's one of the big things, and this was one of those Sparky Imussen rules of thumb or things that he brought to a great deal of attention, was the need to wear your survival gear. That if you have a vest that you carry, that you wear, whatever is on you is going to be what you can escape an aircraft with. And if the airplane catches on fire, then everything in it doesn't count. So, having a a multi-tool in your pocket, having a certain, you know, something to signal, a signal mirror or a lighter. That's a little stuff, but it's one of those things where after writing this article and having done a lot of night flights over the mountains, it's interesting. I used to do this stuff a lot without, I'm not going to say I did it cavalierly or without thinking, but I definitely do it with a lot more thinking now. When I'm over the mountains, I'm looking for, I sure hope the engine doesn't cough, because it's going to be an ugly landing and it's going to be a long time between rescue. And that's one of the other reasons I like flying IFR, is if I'm on an IFR flight plan, I know my rescue is going to be closer at hand if I were to need it. So.
Oh, absolutely. You know, there was a few years back, you might have to help me here. I may have the listeners help me here, but I want to say he was a part of NASA, had his own airplane, flew out of like Colorado through the mountains, and didn't have a VFR, didn't file a VFR flight plan, and then we never saw him again. Like, I don't even think we still to this day have found him. There was a ton of search and rescue along the route of flight, and I don't think we ever found him.
Are you thinking of Steve Fawcett?
Yes, thank you.
Because they eventually find him, but I think it took over a year.
Oh, yeah.
It took over a year to find him. See, I lost track of that story. Over a year, they finally found him. Where did they find him?
It was on a mountainside.
Well, I was just going to say, actually, that one I know, because I always call that the Fawcett factor. Anytime I fly between here and California, where I'm going through the Nevada desert, the Basin Range, that's some really vacant territory. And Fawcett was found, his aircraft wrecked. And I think it was it was a downdraft, basically, that he couldn't climb. Well, that's the theory. I mean, you don't know. All you find is the wreckage. But given the weather of the day, but it was right outside of Mammoth, and he was literally, I think, 10 miles off the runway center line of Mammoth. If you were to take an extended center line and just trace it from the Mammoth Airport towards the Sierras, you would find, you know, he was within 10 miles of an airport. So, but again, rugged country. You know, mountains are amazingly. If you've ever done any mountaineering, when you look at them from a distance, it always looks like, oh, that'll be easy. Or not easy, but it's like, oh, I can see where we need to go. And then when you actually start hiking there and climbing the thousands of feet and up the steep terrain, it's like, wow, this is tough stuff.
Yeah, exactly.
And you know, there was a crash in Idaho last Thanksgiving that was another big, was a CEO from Silicon Valley. Who was flying in a beach bonanza, and on a day that really no airplane that wasn't icing equipped should have even been in a cloud. It was one of those days where all the clouds would have had just a huge amount of ice, and that's what happened. He was lingering in the clouds, and it's one of those things where you really need to be on top. If you shouldn't even be in a cloud at that time of year over that country. But he picked up a load of ice, it brought his, and the airplane went down, but he did declare a mayday, and they had last radar target, because he was on an IFR flight plan, and the airplane was found within a half mile, which is the statistical average, half mile of the last known radar position is where you will find, like 80 or 90% of the time, that's where you're going to find the aircraft wreckage. And it took them a month, over a month. They actually gave up the rescue or the search because it was winter conditions. It was December. There was snow. It was fogged in. And I think it was either 30. It was after 30 days, but I think inside 60 days, they found him and, you know, went down on Thanksgiving-ish, right after Thanksgiving. And it was January or February before they found him. And no survivors. It was a near vertical crash site, so it wasn't very conducive to survival. Plus, the conditions that time of year, you know, winter in the Idaho mountains. And it was right outside of Johnson Creek airstrip, which is really a backcountry airstrip, but it's a pretty friendly, well, relatively friendly backcountry airstrip. It's good for people to get oriented to mountain flying by going into that one as one of the first airstrips you try. And essentially you go right over the wreckage when you're on downwind, turning downwind to base. So it's really right next to an airstrip, but really steep terrain, you know, 1,000 feet, a couple thousand feet of relief. So yeah, the mountains are unforgiving. Part-time pilots, full-time mountains, they're always there.
Well, flying in general is unforgiving. You got to respect it. So, but that's cool. That's great that you wrote all this. I've just with this, I've almost read the entire article. I like your vest. That's your vest in the picture, right?
Yeah, yeah, that's the one. And I what's interesting is I always have had that vest, and I've stocked it, and I would wear it when I was doing backcountry stuff. But I wasn't really all that good about my discipline of wearing that vest. Now I wear it on a lot of, you know, anytime I'm flying over the mountains, because I guess, you know, kind of a come to Jesus when you write an article about survival. You kind of, that's one thing I like about writing about aviation safety is my habits get better every time, because I find that certain things I'm a little lackadaisical on, and it gets me thinking, and now I just can't cross the mountains at night without being a little more cognizant of the risk I'm taking, whereas I used to be, like I said, a little more cavalier about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
We'll have a link to the both the Air Safety Foundation article as well as the actual 12-page paper in the show notes, so that it's kind of a long link, but we'll have a direct link there.
Show notes. So, shout-outs for me. I've got, first of all, shout-out to my co-host for the Airplane Owners podcast, David Phil, mostly because I will be seeing him. I'm going to be heading to Washington, D.C. on a business trip, and we'll be heading out, and hopefully I'm looking forward to getting up in his Aztec if weather and schedules allow, and maybe I might be able to also catch up with, I'm hoping John Conway might be available. Then another shout out really is to another guy from In the Pattern, Brad Kane, who, after I posted about my experience flying an IFR approach, breaking out, hand flying an hour of IFR, he really kind of called me out on, you know, hold it, it's winter, what are you doing flying IFR? And it's really a legit question. And, you know, I kind of downloaded a little bit more on the details that I really wasn't intending. Didn't originally expect that I was going to get into my destination until I had several reports of no icing that I decided I would actually go ahead and change from an airport that was clear and get a look at my home airport and make an attempt. And again, with two positive pie reps that there was no negative ice in the clouds, I went for it. Plus, I also had a report of tops at 7,000. Ceiling was at 5,500, so I had the airport elevation is 4,700. So I had could break out and have as a precision approach. So I felt pretty good about that. But it was pretty sporty doing an IFR at night. So I appreciate the fact that I think pilots should always call out other pilots when you think they're engaging in behaviors that might be risky, because it's a good thing. So thanks to Brad for keeping an eye out. Also, Brendan at Crazed Pilot. I chatted with him a little bit on Skype last night, and he's got a new baby. And by new baby, I mean he has a Saratoga, because he also has a new infant. So he has stepped up in his aviation. So that looked like a great airplane, as well as his baby. He sent me a photo that was so cute. It had a little pacifier binky that said "removed before flight." I thought that was the best thing I'd ever seen. It was so cute. And then an angry shout out to the TSA and all their gates at airports. I hate gates at airports. What a pain getting in and out, trying to land your GA airplane after hours and get back to your GA airplane after hours. All for a little security theater. Arr, angry shake my fist.
I've got several shout outs. First of all, to Kent and Dave Fisher and Carl Valeri and Jack Hodgins and Dan Johnson and way too many other people to mention that I ran into at Sebring. And just I really enjoyed that show, mostly because of the people I could talk to there. And it's a slow paced show, so we actually got the chance to kind of catch up. Also, congratulations to Andy Smith. He's a brand new sport pilot. We've also had Adam Fast and Mike Daniels have both recently visited us and both got checked out in sport cruisers. Adam got to fly with CFI Stu, and Mike flew with me a little bit later.
I was telling Adam for the longest time how amazing those airplanes are, and he's not a fan of the Diamond. He doesn't really like how that how that works. And the only LSA experience I think he had before that was the Skycatcher. So I could understand his hesitation there for a little bit, but he absolutely had a blast in those airplanes. So it's very good. He really enjoyed those. So for my shout-outs, I'm just going to mention some students that I've had recently. I want to give a congratulations to William Mann on getting his private pilot license and on time, too. Good job. And also Elizabeth Brassaw, who's a newly minted CFI. So good job on getting that.
Thank you for listening to the Pilot's Journey podcast. We'd love to hear your comments, suggestions, and experiences. You can reach us at our website at www.pilotsjourney.com or leave us a voicemail at 330-3-JOURNEY. That's 330-356-8763. You can also follow me as Pilot Stu, that's STU, on Twitter or mytransponder.com.
You can reach me on Twitter or MyTransponder as CFIStu, that's STEW, also at CFIStu.com.
And you can follow me on Twitter or MyTransponder as IDMike.
You can also follow us collectively on Twitter or Facebook as Pilot's Journey.
Please note that this podcast is intended for informational and entertainment purposes only. Please consult your own qualified flight instructor before attempting anything discussed in this podcast.
And remember to enjoy the journey.
Copyright 2015, Fully Stewed Productions.
And One Mic.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
The Voices in Your Head.com.